You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist radio show airing on Sundays between 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm Bursa Goodness.
And I'm William Goodenough.
The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. You can email us at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net with anything you want. And you can send us snail mail at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. This show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee, located at 610 Haywood Road. Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. Firestorm's full catalog of books and zines can be found online at firestorm.coop. We're speaking with Lawrence Chirac. Lawrence is the author of many articles and topics ranging from post-left anarchy to the Spanish Civil War to civilization to technology and organization. Lawrence is currently a co-editor of Anarchy, a Journal of Desire Armed. AJODA, as I'll be referring to it here, has been operating since 1980 and is now published currently once a year. I really appreciate you chatting, Lawrence.
Oh, happy to be here.
Can you talk a bit about AJODA, its history, and how it developed during your tenure as co-editor?
Sure. Well, we took over from Jason McQuinn, who was looking to get out of the project to start something new, which he did with Modern Slavery, which is a big fat magazine, more long-form essays than what we do in AJODA. And so that's where he went. He wanted to make sure that the integrity of the project remained well. So he trusted me, and I hope I've earned that trust. And I was able to generate some interest with other people in the area in various combinations. We've solidified down to a hardcore of three for the last, I don't even know how many years now, 4 or 5 years now. And we use Charles at Eberhard Press as our layout and design person. And we're very, very happy with the way the magazine has looked since he took over. And the three of us decided a few years back that once a year publishing schedule was going to work better for us since we all have lives outside of the magazine. Magazine takes a lot of time, and so does stuff that we do outside of the magazine, anarchist or not. And so we just decided to do it once a year and make that so that we wouldn't go completely crazy. If we had more people involved, we would consider publishing it twice a year again, perhaps. But at this point, it's an annual event, and we bring it out in the spring. So our last issue came out a few months back, and we're pretty happy with this issue. We've tried to regenerate the web presence. None of us are particularly tech-savvy, nor are any of the three of us that good at marketing ideas. So our subscriber base is fairly steady, but we would love to increase it. And subscriptions are available through the website. If people are interested, it's anarchymag.org. And one of the things that we do at the magazine that's probably different from most other periodicals, and this is something that Jason implemented when he first started the magazine, is that we print all the letters that we get, with the exclusion of death threats and, obviously meandering, incoherent things. But we do publish all the letters that we get. Sometimes we have few letters. Sometimes we have a lot of letters. Sometimes, one or two really long letters and a couple that are just one or two sentences. But we try to maintain those open communication lines with our readership to make sure that we know what we're doing and they know what we're doing.
In an interview that you did with Free Radical Radio earlier this year, you talked about the small readership or subscription base as kind of a sign of a positive engagement. Do you recall what I'm talking about?
I remember the interview. I'm not sure that I remember characterizing it as a positive thing. I mean, I'm always more interested in quality than quantity, that's for sure. We would love to have more subscribers. That would be really cool. We just don't know how to get them.
I often think of AJODA as a project that espouses or at least makes ample room for critiques coming from a post-left anarchist perspective. Is this something you consider to be correct about the magazine?
Absolutely, yes. Although I would not characterize it as the discourse as post-left anarchist. Post-left anarchism is is kind of a clunky way to describe it. I prefer to call the discourse post-left anarchy rather than kind of solidify it into another kind of ideological framework. One of the things that a post-left discourse tries to do is reject ideological frameworks, and that's definitely a project that is near and dear to Jason's heart. But we try to do the same thing. A lot of people don't recognize or don't understand that there's a difference between anarchism and anarchy. I never get tired of trying to explain the difference. So anarchy is a term for a condition of existence for people living outside of the state or without the state. So anarchy is just that. It's a description. It's not an ideology. It's not a program. It doesn't require specific tenets or principles in order to exist. And if you look at the anthropological record, most anthropologists would agree that 99% of human history, we existed without the dubious benefit of the state or governance or government or any other kind of institutionalized hierarchical framework for mediating social conflict. So I would say that anarchy as a condition of human existence is the most successful model. And in fact, governance is the aberration in human history. Anarchism is a political philosophy that describes the problems with statecraft, the problems that are generated by institutionalized hierarchies, institutionalized forms of oppression, and the existence of anarchism requires anarchists. The condition of anarchy doesn't require anarchists. In fact, I would argue in my more bitter moments that it's probably better off without anarchists. So that's a distinction that I think is important to emphasize. Now, the post-left part of that is where things get a little tricky, because most people who are involved in politics are so accustomed to the binary of left versus right. So post-left folks are often accused of engaging in a right-wing discourse just because of a lack of imagination or a lack of subtlety on the part of the left critics of the post-left anarchy discourse. But we don't say we're post-right because there is not a rightist tradition in anarchism historically. There has been a left anarchist, and there still is a left anarchist history and tradition. And there are certainly left anarchists. Anarcho-syndicalists would be in that group. Most anarchist communists would be in that group. And the post-left discourse points to some of the unfortunate overlaps that left anarchists have with non-anarchist leftists. A tendency toward organization for the sake of organization, a tendency toward mass movement, a tendency toward mass culture, a tendency toward a bureaucratization of organization, no matter how big or how small. So for post-left folks, well, I can't speak for all of us. Let me just speak for myself and a couple of examples. I would say that post-left anarchy discourse is pointing toward the anti-bureaucratic roots of anarchism as a distinct political philosophy. So I am not really trying to be innovative. I am trying to remind other anarchists of a very deep skepticism and or rejection of organization for the sake of organization, bureaucratic mechanisms and institutions, alliances with people who would prefer that you are a body and not a speaking person or a thinking person. There's what I see as a great deal of conformity in left anarchist thought and practice, and I rebel against that. One of the things that post-left anarchy promoters are not afraid of is the
the dualist tradition in anarchism, which has been a minority position historically, but it has been there nonetheless. And to ignore it and or denigrate it as somehow not genuine is, I think, historically untenable and intellectually dishonest. But now I'm starting to get off on tangents, so I'm going to...
Tangents are great, personally. I love tangents.
Okay, well, for a good introduction to that, the individualist end of what could be considered a broad post-left discourse, I definitely recommend the book Enemies of Society, published by Little Black Cart several years back. And it is all about the egoist, nihilist tradition in historical anarchism. It's an anthology, so some of the stuff in there is not really great, and there's a couple of authors in there that I find really irritating, but it is an important document nonetheless. A tendency that most left anarchists despise and or ignore, depending on who they are and where they're coming from at a particular moment and what kind of ideological points they want to score.
Can you talk a bit more about the critique of mass culture and movements within post-left anarchy? Some have taken this to be a sort of poo-pooing of the majority of people, as in they're too dumb or not ubermensch enough or whatever to be worked with or to assume that you have anything in common with them.
Well, there is an aspect of the discourse that has that in it, and that's definitely a part of the egoist discourse that I don't find convincing. Sounds very elitist to say, oh, most people are just dumb. And my experiences in the world of work, which I have done since I got out of college, I work with normal people. I don't work with political radicals. I don't work with anybody at my workplace, which has over 300 employees right now, who considers himself an anarchist. I think there was one a couple of years ago, but she moved on to something bigger and better. So I don't have regular day-to-day conversations with anarchists most of the time. And my sense is that most people are actually pretty intelligent. They're not stupid. They have been spoon-fed a bunch of bad information from the times that they were little kids. Public schooling is obviously an institution of indoctrination into the status quo. And it would be foolish to think that most people who come out of that are somehow going to become political radicals, that there will be one turning point or several turning points in their lives where they will wake up somehow and say, oh, I was taught all of this bad stuff. This is all bad information that I've been getting. You know, if that were the case, then there would be a lot more radicals in the world than there are now. The fact that education / indoctrination is continues despite all the budget cuts and school closings, is that it's actually an effective way to keep people invested in the status quo. So that's a part of the egoist tradition that makes me uncomfortable, because I actually don't think people are stupid. Most people are intelligent enough to know that when anarchists talk to them, what it sounds like anarchists are saying is that they just want to be better bosses or better instructors or better leaders than the ones that exist now. And that's certainly been my experience with most of the anarchists that I've engaged with over the last 30-odd years that I've been doing this stuff. So my sense is actually quite opposite of what that sounds like, and that is that most normal people, if normal is the non-political radical people, most normal people can see through the anarchist nonsense and know that what it means when the anarchists say what they're going to do is it means probably longer hours at work and a lot more meetings. And who the hell wants that?
Instead of a meeting, what do you propose?
There's an interesting way of looking at how decisions are made in groups. And in some of the sociological or anthropological literature, they talk about the meeting or the organization meeting versus the campfire. And the organization meeting is when you get a bunch of people together and you decide on an agenda, and you have, you know, spokesperson for a particular agenda, and it's the butcher block paper, everyone sitting in a circle using consensus model decision making. It's all very formalized. You know, there, and since Occupy, there are all these, well, it's before Occupy, but since the popularity of Occupy, now you've got all these hand signals for how you interrupt somebody who's saying something that you have an answer to, et cetera, et cetera. So you've got the crazy hand signals. That's all formalized. General assemblies that took place during Occupy, those are formal decision-making bodies. Campfire, on the other hand, is much more informal. And in fact, it's difficult to call that a decision-making body because it is so informal. It doesn't have agenda necessarily. It doesn't have cliques. It doesn't have incipient bureaucracy involved in it. The argument of the organizer meeting folks is that Campfire is a clique. And so when those folks come over into the general meeting, now they have their own little block and they've got their own particular agenda that we've decided beforehand. And that's where the whole tyranny of structurelessness argument comes in. But I would say that the Campfire is probably the better way to make decisions. Whether you can do that sustainably on a large scale is a different question. So the issue of mass culture, to get back to your original question, the reason why I have a strong critique sliding toward a rejection of mass culture is because you wind up with a situation where conformity is rewarded, where being a dissident or a issue disturber or any kind of deviant from the norm, whatever the norm might be, is a lonely and unrewarding place to be. As an anarchist without adjectives, I would say that there should be a high value placed on dissent, a high value placed on issue disturbers, a high value placed on that kind of questioning of conformity, because conformity leads to stagnation, as far as I can tell. And the constant butting of heads against conformity and against stagnation is what I see as the strength of anarchism as a discrete political philosophy. Without it, I don't think there's much worth in it, in anarchism.
And that's one accusation that like, or one bogeyman or straw man or whatever that people put up and about anarchists is that, like, oh, you're just arguing for the sake of argument. You don't even believe what you're saying. You're just, you know, you're just Diogenes or whatever with the dogs. Like, is that something that you think is valuable, or is that just a caricature?
I think that's a caricature. My experience is that most anarchists argue for the sake of an actual position. Now, whether they can argue for that position or not is a separate issue, and that may be a reflection of what people object to, that because the ideas are so bizarre, that is outside of the framework of what would be considered normal politics, it can probably sound like I'm just arguing for the sake of arguing, and they may not actually believe what they say, but my experience is different. My experience is that most anarchists really do believe what they say. They just may not be able to say it the best way.
That's fair. A few minutes ago, you pointed to the accusation by some that the post-left is actually on the right. And I understand this argument that the spectrum is a contrivance and based on, like, a stupid event and setup during the French Revolution. And not being able to think outside that box is a bit dumb. But there are folks on what I'd consider to be the right or the reactionary side of people, so-called national anarchists, who self-identify as being post-left also. Do you personally consider them to be a part of the post-left anarchy family, or are they just...
No, definitely not. I mean, I know that one of my essays was linked to the Bay Area National Anarchist website many years back when they actually still had, you know, their three people involved. As far as I can tell, those folks have all moved away, and they've jettisoned any pretense to being anarchists at all. The fact that they linked to my essay doesn't mean that there was any actual affinity between our
our respective ideas. The reason that they linked to my essay was because they don't like the left, and I'm not crazy about it either. And that's why they linked to my essay. But I did write a little column about that, you know, what is the responsibility of a writer? And my decision was that my writing should not be used to the advantage of any of my enemies. So I told the Bay Area National Anarchist to fuck off and stop linking to my essay. Not that I think that they're relevant or powerful or interesting, but even if they're not, I don't want anything to do with those people. They're completely reactionary. They have nothing in common with an actual anarchist tradition. Because as most people who are sophisticated about their anarchism will already know, anarchism doesn't mean just being against the state. There's other things involved in it as well. And the folks who are involved in national anarchism, I put a big sick after that in parentheses, their ideas are very far away from any kind of traditional understanding of anarchism. We have nothing in common with them.
There might be another reason, too, that the... I'm cheating because I'm looking at Wikipedia, but Richard Hunt, who is a British editor, or he is on the editorial board of Green Anarchist magazine, which is not to be confused with Green Anarchy published out of Eugene. But that person went on to podcasting and self-identified and publishing, and self-identified as a national anarchist, but also post-leftist too. So there is that, as stupid as their ideology or philosophy may be, there is like a tendency that exists prior to your writing of that essay, you know?
For sure. And, you know, I can't prevent anyone from calling themselves whatever they want. But if you actually take a look at Hunt's stuff or any of the other third positionist stuff, you'll see that if you scratch just a little bit of the surface, the pretense to being against institutionalized hierarchies disappears very quickly. The institutionalized hierarchy that all the Northern European third positionists want is white power. They don't like the state because they believe that the state is not loyal to whiteness. There's nothing about that has any commonality with any kind of anarchism anywhere. Because the term anarchism has a certain cachet in a marginal kind of political discourse, for a long time it was really fashionable for just about anybody to just throw the anarchist label on themselves or not to object when other people threw it on them. I mean, think of somebody like Naomi Klein. She was called an anarchist when she first started writing her anti-globalist stuff. Yeah, I mean, it makes me laugh. No, she's some kind of social democrat. Nothing to do with anarchism. If you asked her, I'm sure she would now deny that she's an anarchist or ever was one, which would be the honest way to go. But you can't stop other people from characterizing you in a particular way. Same way you can't stop somebody from self-identifying in a particular way, even if it has nothing to do with history, nothing to do with any kind of recognized tradition. So I can't stop Richard Hunt from calling himself an anarchist. I mean, I could object to it. If he were relevant to my life, I would object to it. It's not relevant. Once you stop being involved in Green Anarchist, you stop being relevant.
I've appreciated the critiques that you and other authors between Ajota and GA have brought over the years. But I just, like, there's certain points that when I hear other people addressing post-left anarchy and or insurrectional anarchy or green anarchism, like, I hear people just bring up, like, oh, green anarchists, like, they just want the mass die-off of the human race, and they're, you know, blah, 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 blah. And these post-left anarchy people are just too agitated to sit through a meeting and, you know.
Well, I am agitated to sit through a meeting. I'm also old enough to know what's going to happen at the meeting, and I'm thoroughly bored by it. I've got better things to do with my life.
So I enjoyed the last issue, number 76, of Ajota very much. Usually the issues contain multiple articles, but this one featured one long piece entitled Against Identity Politics. Without putting words in the author's mouth, can you talk about the article and why y'all chose to feature it so prominently?
Well, the article is, I would consider, long overdue in the anarchist scene. I tried to provoke a discussion about identity politics several years back with a short essay, well, short group of
aphorism is maybe called Preliminary Theses for a Longer Discussion on the Problem of Identity of Essentialism and Identity Politics. Anyway, it didn't go very far. There was one discussion about it. I was quoted out of context. It was basically a hatchet job by somebody with an axe to grind against me personally, and that was not a discussion that ever happened. But the current essay, I think, is much better than my initial attempt. It's more comprehensive and takes into account all kinds of sociological and psychological issues, as well as political issues. And the thesis is essentially, if I can use that word in a non-ironic way, that identity politics creates identity police. And when you have a group of people who are wedded to a particular identity, the necessity to police the boundaries of that identity grows up along with the identity. And so you wind up with a particular set of social practices based on antagonistic relationships that are certainly not exclusive to identity politicians, but they are the ones who interact most with anarchists these days. And it's especially prevalent in an activist context. It certainly was one of the, from my perspective, it was one of the reasons why Occupy internally fizzled. It had nothing to do with the repression of the state, which was quite enormous and coordinated. But the issue of identity politics was one of the Achilles heels of Occupy. Since whenever the issue was addressed, it was only addressed by identity police, and they made most other people who were just getting into social activism, or at least public social activism, made them very uncomfortable. On a basic level, it told them that they were worthless because they did not understand the role of historical oppression in the way that police behave or the way the state behaves. And again, like the egoist elitism of calling people stupid, and they're too stupid to understand this. This is basically what identity politicians are saying to, you know, the new crop of activists, is that you're too stupid to understand racism, you're too stupid to understand colonialism, so listen to what I say, do what I say, or we're going to call you out, right? We're going to denounce you publicly, we're going to heckle you at an event, we're going to shut you down, whatever other mechanisms that they can devise for making a person feel unwelcome, chastised, otherwise outside the bounds of polite discourse. A lot of what the essay is about is the actual mechanisms of that policing and how they are rooted in a discourse that is basically malice and very influenced by ideas of social conformity and creation of an alternative set of hierarchical institutions, basically. And that's why I thought that it was timely, for sure, and important to get out there, and we wanted to provoke some kind of discussion.
And have you gotten much feedback on the article?
None. We've had no feedback on it whatsoever.
Seriously? There's so much in there that's really surprising.
Well, it's only available in print, although somebody did scan it and post it online somewhere. You can probably search for it, but there's no. I think on that website there's no discussion forum function, so I still haven't heard anything. I mean, I heard one of our subscribers wrote us and said, "Wow, it's great! I'm so glad you wrote this. That will be published in the next issue." But no, that just a fan letter is not really a discussion as important as fan letters are. Yeah, so we haven't posted it online anywhere. We want people to read it in the magazine. Maybe that's a mistake on our part in terms of marketing. But maybe we'll put a couple of paragraphs on our website, see if that generates anything.
So maybe we can, not to dissuade, but maybe to entice people into engagement with the essay, and hopefully purchasing a copy with your hard-earned American cash. Could we parse some of the ideas in it?
Yeah.
One of our discussion groups here in town ended up reading it, and it was a pretty divisive conversation, and a lot of people were made really uncomfortable by it, by the content, or just poo-pooed it. I've said poo-poo twice now. That's pretty bad. But one of the things that the author, who is going by Lupus Dragonell, talks about when making the statement of that it comes from a Maoist tradition is referring to something called the principal contradiction, which I had to Wikipedia, and because I don't have a full Maoist library in my house, sadly. Can you break down that idea, or do you want me to go into, like...
It comes right out of Marxism, and it is the idea that you can look at all of these other mechanisms of exploitation and oppression that exist in industrial culture, but really the main thing that unites them all, or that has them all under its umbrella, is capitalism. So the principal contradiction is the contradiction between worker and owner, or in usual Marxist terminology, between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. So the way that principal contradiction all of the other forms of exploitation and oppression is by saying once that principal contradiction is resolved, i.e. through the dictatorship of the proletariat, then all of these other institutions will wither away, just like the state is supposed to wither away. The anarchist critique of that kind of logic has always been, I think, that these other institutionalized oppressions and forms of exploitation may be the result of having a capitalist-based economy. But many of the forms of those hierarchies that pre-exist capitalism as a discrete economic system. So the argument that the oppression of women, or the domination of women by men, is older than capital is a very convincing argument. You can look at cultures that do not have capitalist-based social and economic relations, and you can see the oppression of women. You can see that there is a tendency of the old to rule over the young, and not just because they have more experience, but because they have a tendency to do that, to be bossy. So the idea that there is a principal contradiction and the resolution of those contradictions, or the Hegelian synthesis of those contradictions, will somehow naturally flow from the resolution of the principal contradiction is belied by actual cultural history. If you look at any of the models that various Marxist sects point to in the 20th century as having resolved the principal contradiction, even in a deformed way, that certain Trotskyists like to look at the former Soviet Union under Stalin, see it as fundamentally a worker state, but it was deformed by a bureaucracy. Whole different discussion. You can still see in a worker's state, according to the Marxists, that there is still patriarchy, there is still racism, there is still a yearning for some kind of colonial relationship with other states. The notion of a principal contradiction is somehow this. Solving that principal contradiction is this magical way of resolving all other social contradictions from an anarchist perspective. Completely absurd.
There's also the argument that when the principal contradiction can shift between subjects as needed by whatever vanguard there is, like suddenly, oh, because of this situation, it's no longer about just capitalism, it's about imperialism, or it's about, you know, whatever happens to be the contradiction of the day, the, you know, du jour.
Yeah, that's a process that Marxists call dialectics, and as a very funny person once said, dialectics is what Marxists invoke when you catch them in a lie. So yeah, the revolutionary subject changes based on what sect of Marxism you're going for, and also it has to do with wherever the Marxists think they can gain some kind of political traction. So if it is an issue of patriarchy or the oppression of women, then patriarchy is the primary contradiction that all others stem from. And it's especially attractive for people who take a more, I don't know if accurate is the word that I want to use, but a more sophisticated understanding of history, to look at the aspects of oppression that
predate capitalism. I think one of the better examples of that, sort of, is Sylvia Federici's *Caliban and the Witch*. It also has its own problems because she's only looking at cultures that eventually did become capitalist, and doesn't look into the ways that women have been oppressed and or exploited in cultures that did not develop into capitalist cultures. That is a failing of her as a researcher. But her point is still well taken, that the subjugation of women predates the subjugation of a mass of people called proletarians. And that's a fairly decent example of the shifting of the primary contradiction, but it doesn't get at the issue of the problem of formulating an analysis based on a primary contradiction. And that's actually something that, at least in its beginning stages, certainly not anymore, but the beginning stages of the discourse on intersectionality took that as a given, that there are different locations of oppression and exploitation that have maybe something to do with capitalism, but maybe not. And it doesn't mean that those institutions are any less oppressive because they don't have capitalism as part of their mechanism. I mean, at this point, the intersectionality discourse, at least in academia, has become completely sidetracked into a way to say, basically, if you don't accept intersectionality, then you are racist, sexist, pro-imperialist, blah, blah, blah. And it's being used as another bludgeon by people on the left, especially in academia.
It seems like intersectionality, and I'm outside of academia, so I don't see how the left is interacting with that in academia necessarily, but it seems like the idea of intersectionality allows for an attack on the idea that there's a pyramid of, like, a hierarchy of oppressions, right?
Yes, the discourse began exactly in that way, and it has been turned around into another boundary to police. Some of the stuff that takes place in intersectionality discourse is really horrific to me. I don't have any examples at my fingertips at the moment, but the author of our essay has a bunch of examples, and the correspondence that we've had since the issue was published, you know, he's pointing me to a bunch of these things, and they're really not cool.
So there's specific practices, and if I'm like beating a dead horse with this article, let me know, or going down an uninteresting path for you. But there's like instances in the article where it does point to, besides primary contradiction, as like laying a foundation as to the main focus of a certain group's way of interacting and shutting down any argument that doesn't center the argument that they want to focus on. There is also pointing to other Maoist tendencies within some of the activities that are taken on by folks who the author identifies as identity politicians. So like calling out to some degree, like maybe accountability processes, denunciations, interruptions, threats, things like this. And the author makes the statement or the claim that this can be traced back to the like Maoism that came into the left in the U.S. in the 1960s.
Yeah, I mean, that stuff all happened during the Cultural Revolution. And those practices were adopted by American Maoists, adopted by international Maoists, pretty much everywhere, as a successful toolkit for exposing class traitors, essentially. And a class traitor is anybody who doesn't follow the party line. That's how I see it, as a cynic. But I suppose there's some kind of internal logic in Maoism that allows people to engage in that kind of denunciation. There's also the famous criticism, self-criticism session, which in the United States especially degenerated into what's called a fishbowl, where one person sits in the middle of their ostensible comrades, and everyone takes turns denouncing them for their failures as a revolutionary. And the person eventually has to agree that all of these characterizations are correct, or they get kicked out of the party. I mean, it's just the most I think, transparent way of generating group conformity. And there were certainly mind control aspects of it, and there was at least one cult-like Maoist sect in the Bay Area back in the 70s that engaged in this kind of process regularly.
Some of the survivors have talked about it publicly.
Yeah, it's very easy to go down that path. And it's essentially a tool for generating conformity, group cohesion, and internal conformity. I would have thought that anarchists with the name would be able to see right through that kind of authoritarian nonsense, but I am wrong, as I have been frequently on occasion, more than once.
Well, you heard it here on The Final Straw. Lauren Chirac is wrong. Just kidding.
Frequently.
Like any human being. Do you think that the return of those methods, and maybe it's not so much a return as the amplification of those methods, is a product of Maoism coming back, or is it just that certain groups of people are finding these activities to be useful for controlling the controlling debate, shutting people down?
Yeah, I don't know that I would call it a resurgence of Maoism. There is this tendency of current crop of activists look back on the late 60s and early 70s period, especially in a United States context, as this time of
like a watershed.
Yeah, this and a time of revolutionary greatness when people really believed that revolution was on the horizon, whatever revolution meant to them, but that groups like the Weather Underground, Red Army faction in Germany, the Japanese Red Army, and various other armed struggle groups, they were the pinnacle of revolutionary internationalist solidarity with third world struggles for self-determination, and decolonization, etc. So if you accept that those groups and those practices that they were engaged in were the pinnacle of revolutionary excitement or purity or potential victory, then of course you're going to look at the application of various of their methodologies, at least internally, to your own activism. And I don't think that it's necessarily a conscious embrace of Maoism as much as it is an embrace of mechanisms to create conformity and cohesion. What better way to generate cohesion, to engage in a ruthless denunciation of backsliding toward a bourgeois existence among radicals? That's such an easy target, and the easiest way to do that is to find some kind of personal failing in whoever you decide has that failing, and to elevate that personal failure into some kind of world historical importance as a betrayal of fundamental principles, as an inadequate rupture with their own past, whatever terminology is used in invoking this kind of activity doesn't really matter. What's important is that the rest of the group gets to bond with this experience. And that's what's one of the things that Lucas talks about as his essays, is the kind of cathartic experience that people get when they're engaged in this kind of activity. If you want to be part of something that you conceive of as bigger than yourself, even bigger than your group of a half a dozen or a dozen people, it's very easy to find personal failures of your comrades or your allies as being really, really, really important to point out, to denounce, have an accountability process around. If this person's failures are based in their adherence, despite their whatever indoctrination they've been getting in the group, so they remain adherents of some kind of bourgeois cultural artifact, if you call them on the carpet for that, if you denounce them for that, and they agree, and then they decide that whatever the group does to them is justifiable in the name of revolution or social justice or whatever it is that they're promoting, that's a really intense bonding experience for the rest of the people in the group. It definitely builds cohesion. Much better than a game of capture the flag does.
I could see it also being, on some psychological level, cathartic to the individual who like goes through the denunciation practice or like session and then is like sort of born again in the new revolutionary spirit of like, I have failed the revolution, but I will not again. I am washed clean in the waters.
Yeah, it's very Christian. Very Christian. It's a baptism by fire, essentially. And it's a powerful thing. No question. If it didn't work, people wouldn't use it still.
This episode of The Final Straw features Burst's me interviewing Lauren Chirac, the co-editor, one of the co-editors of Anarchy, a Journal of Desire Armed, about identity politics, about call-out culture, about individualist anarchism, and much, much more.
You may have already said this, but how do you think that this damages actual struggles in the United States? I mean, besides alienating individuals who are on the wrong end of the call-out culture, but how does this damage actual attempts to address like institutionalized racism, institutionalized sexism, all of these oppressive hierarchies that do fundamentally exist within our current world, right?
Well, the main thing that happens is that I don't want to get too psychological toward the people who are engaging in this kind of activity, but what I see is that it's very difficult to attack an institution because you still have to attack individuals who are part of that institution. And those folks are insulated. They're insulated by dominant ideas of what common sense is. They're insulated by an entire legislative system. They're insulated by the police. So they are hard to get at. You can shake your fist outside of a meeting of people you believe are responsible for most of the ills in the world. So, for example, the G8 summit or the G20 summit or whatever the G is at the meeting that's near your home. You can stand outside of those meetings and shake your fist with 1,000 other people. Police can try to keep you in a protest ghetto. That's all really difficult, and it's difficult to see any kind of victory come out of those kind of campaigns, even if they're protracted campaigns, even if they don't have enormously abstract end games. It's much easier to find an individual who may or may not be part of an institution, but who represents that to you, who is close by, who is known to you personally, who is engaged in similar kind of activity, and because of one slight or another, or maybe many slights over a period of months or years, you take that person into an accountability process. You have found someone to denounce. You have found someone to have influence over. And if they disagree with the call out or the accountability process, and then they leave your group or they leave your end of the struggle, that is a victory because you've now purified your struggle from a baleful influence of somebody who represents status quo. If, on the other hand, they agree with your denunciation and they internalize all of the actions that you have thrown at them as a way to bring them, hold them to account, right? Or they engage in the self-crit session, and at the end of it, they are self-critical and they agree that your path is the best path. That is also a victory because now you have one more cadre in your organization who is, you know, now after this baptism of fire is 100% committed to the cause. So either way, it's a victory for the person doing the denunciation. And again, if it didn't work, they'd stop doing it.
But when you're saying work, which you said twice, what you're not referring to necessarily what the proposed product of or outcome that the people conducting the session are necessarily doing, right? Or they're not like saying like, actually, we are making you a better revolutionary subject.
Yeah.
What they're doing is they're making you, well, I guess like they're making you more of a subject, right?
Well, they're subjecting you to stuff. Yeah, that's for sure. But you, if you withstand the process and you come out agreeing with their denunciations, right, you are now an officially accepted member of the group. So that is a victory for the group. If you wind up dying, that is also a victory because now they don't have to worry about you anymore. But the it works in terms. It is a victory for the group because they have engaged with a representative or someone they believe is a representative of all this bad stuff, and they have either transformed them or denounced them so badly that they no longer have any kind of influence over the course of whatever campaign is being organized. The problem with that, not just in terms of alienating people who have to sit through it or who have to witness it, that it mistakes individual behavior for institutionalized relation. We are all products of whatever culture we grew up in, no question. So whatever vestiges we still have of that are there. They don't just go away. You don't become anti-patriarchal just because you decide one day that you're an anarchist. You have to actually do stuff about it. And if you fall short of the expectations of people who have been engaged in anti-patriarchal activities for a long, long time, they've got a couple of choices. They can hold your hand and say, hey, you've got to do this, this, and this, or they can denounce you and say you're a sexist scumbag and we don't want to have anything to do with you. So the problem with that is that, again, the people who are engaged in that kind of denunciation are making a categorical error. They are seeing in a microcosm, that is, in an individual, the representative of an institutionalized hierarchy, a long-standing, multi-generational aspect of a exploitative and oppressive culture.
So in like a Stirnerist tradition, what they would be, they're confusing the individual for the specter of, or that like social category that's a construct.
Right, and that's what Lupus talks about a lot in his essay as well, is that categorical mistake. You know, a person is not the sum total of the aspects of their appearance or their presentation. I am male-bodied, and I am relatively masculine-looking, but being a man in a patriarchal culture is not the beginning and end of who I am, not the beginning and end of any single male-identified or male-bodied person. Not how it works. And that's why I think that at least at the beginnings of intersectionality discourse was really, really important, because it looks at the multitude of intersecting and non-intersecting, parallel oppressions that exist all at the same time, and even within the same individual. The same individual can be both an oppressor and victim of oppression. And for people who are only interested in a primary contradiction, it really messes with their heads. It doesn't make sense to them, because everything really is about a large social category or a class, if you will. And I would hope that an anarchist analysis would be a little more sophisticated than that. But again, I've been proved wrong on that count as well. And maybe that's because I actually believe that anarchists who call themselves anarchists are actually anarchists. Maybe that's my naivete.
So is the argument then the intersectionality that Lupus is coming across in these journals, this is just for my own edification, is like tending to like weave a tighter cloth out of someone having more oppressed circumstances, and therefore that puts them higher in a hierarchy rather than someone who's got less of those threads, is more like a cheesecloth.
Yeah, it does seem like intersectionality has now become the more objective way of competing in the oppression Olympics. Sorry to sound so cynical about that, but it really what it has come to mean in a lot of locations is that, yeah, we've got all these multiple oppressions, but I have more of them than you do, so I'm actually objectively more oppressed than you. Mm-hmm. And again, that's a debasement of how intersectionality discourse began.
So with folks that are like, for instance, I've been involved in like an accountability group before, and the purpose was to, if someone had been hurt or someone had been attacked, to go and confront the person who attacked or hurt or was perceived to have hurt an individual. I guess you can't say that. If somebody feels hurt, they're hurt. Like whether or not that was the intention of the other person or the memory of the other person, that's a separate issue. But found participation in that group to be really complex and tiring, and by the end of it, at least in my experience, not very successful project. Through the few instances that we interacted with, it was productive in terms of a lot of conversations around consent and a lot of conversations around like, when you push this person, this is how it feels to them. Maybe you shouldn't do that sort of thing. You know, pretty like simple conversations around consent and around communication. But I think there's a lot of like good intention that goes into the sort of idea that, okay, we have this model of something that we can try to implement within our communities that doesn't require and is actually counter to the use of police, prisons, and courts. And we could just do it as a sort of, you know, DIY.
But one of the problems is that it reproduces in a lot of ways the same models that the judicial system operates off of and that the police operate off of.
If it does that, it does it worse.
Yeah.
Because at least in the judicial system, you've got the presumption of innocence, and there's got to be some kind of proof involved, that there's got to be some kind of impartiality involved with somebody who's sitting in judgment of this, whether it's a jury or an actual judge. When it's a group of people involved in the same kind of activities that you know, pardon the legalistic language, the perpetrator and the victim are involved in, what you have is basically a group of vigilantes. And it may seem like it's directly democratic, but from the outside, if I'm looking at this situation from the outside, it looks a lot like mob justice to me. And that makes me really uncomfortable. I know that there is no good way in a culture that is based on these kinds of legalities. There's no good way to counter that with the idea that you've got to have some kind of independent investigative body, and you've got to have some kind of impartial judge or panel of judges in order to make some kind of actual justice come at the end of it. It's complicated, and I don't envy you your experience. It sounds like it's very tiring because you have to be a detective, a lawyer, and a juror all at the same time.
And when doing support for the accused perpetrator or whatever, that means also like being a psychologist or a counselor. And in my off time, right, when I'm not doing my wage work.
Right. Like, wow, who's got the time for that kind of stuff? I mean, I recognize that conflict resolution is a really important aspect of any kind of culture or subculture. Super important. It's one of the things that I really enjoyed studying when I was studying anthropology in college. Different mechanisms of conflict resolution are really interesting. None of the models that I studied sounded in any way much better in terms of the actual end result, if the end result was wanting some kind of accountability, right, which really just means blame or responsibility for doing something bad, then most of the conflict resolution mechanisms were not actually about that. They were more performance.
You were saying that most of the outcomes that seemed to be expected were more like performative and retributive, I guess.
Well, not retributive. The ones that were more successful were the ones that were not retributive, but were performative. And they don't even follow the model of restorative justice that is so popular among certain activist crowds. In fact, it had very little to do with the actual transgression of a particular individual, and more the, again, it was an exercise in social cohesion, but it didn't involve necessarily the kind of denunciation that I associate with identity politics.
Is there a model for conflict resolution that you think would be more functional within a community that believed in some degree of accountability or like respect among people when somebody transgresses against someone else? How does that get resolved? Not expecting you to have all the answers or anything like that, but just I'm curious about what your perspective is on it.
I don't even have an answer to that. I mean, really, because of all of the cultural baggage that each of us carries with them, I don't think that there is a positive model of conflict resolution that's workable above a small group of people who already know and trust each other. I just can't see it. I mean, living in a place like the Bay Area, where there are so many different anarchist factions that you can go your entire life in the Bay Area active as an anarchist, active as a social justice organizer, et cetera, and never interact with people from another clique. It's that bad. And the lack of interaction is mostly based on loyalty to personalities. In that way, it's sad, but in another sense, it's perfectly okay, because whatever transgressions are perceived in one group, just go to a different group, and they either will not have heard about it, or it may not be earth-shattering to them. It's a strange situation here with factionalism. It's been that way for as long as I can remember, although the factions were smaller back in the early days when I was involved in the mid-80s. The factions were there nonetheless. It's kind of weird, you know, that I don't think there's ever going to be, you know, a single model of an anarchist form of conflict resolution that's going to work across all facets of anarchist subcultures. And part of me thinks that's okay, part of me thinks that's sad.
I mean, we're not all interchangeable pieces. That's something to be said, and that's fine. That's a good, like, starting point. But it seems like a scary thing if, I mean, at least the internet does some stuff to be able to allow for this sort of thing. But if someone is perhaps like a confidential source to law enforcement and they've got enough cred or enough cultural passage within anarchist or punk or what queer circles that they can just sort of like shift from community to community and keep tabs on people. If there's not that communication between those different communities that are so similar, or if there's a serial rapist that is among the communities that like continually will just like do this, get called out, and then like shift to Santa Cruz or shift to New York or Chicago or something like that. That's scary.
Yeah, I've heard of that happening too. And it's a failure of people's politics. But on the other hand, what do you do about false allegations? Again, when you're in a situation where you have to be the investigator, prosecutor, the defense, the jury, the psychologist, and the counselor, that's just too many things to do at once. Too many balls to juggle in the air at the same time. And if most of the conflict resolution stuff requires people to be psychologists, then you'll always fail, because most people are not psychologists. And again, you've got all this cultural baggage. Like some people, I would consider myself part of this faction. I would much rather have retributive justice than restorative justice. Maybe that's because I grew up on the West Coast.
Maybe it's because, you know, my parents are who they are. Maybe it's because of the movies I watched when I was growing up. I don't know. But, like, whenever I hear people on the radio talk about restorative justice, or whenever I've overheard people talking about restorative justice, it just sounds wimpy to me. Not that I'm all macho-ish, but it doesn't sound like it's a real resolution. If there's a real conflict, you got to hash it out. You can't just say, well, I'm sorry I hurt your feelings. Yeah, the reason you hurt my feelings is because of this, this, and this, and I feel like a great injustice has been done, and how are you going to fix that? You're not going to fix that by baking me a loaf of bread and inviting me over for a beer. But I'm old and cranky, so that may be some part of it, too.
I mean, there's like elements of it that seem in some of the literature coming out from The Revolution Starts at Home, right, is this compilation of abuse stories and the subtitle is Confronting Intimate Violence Within Activist Communities. And it has just like tons of different folks' experiences of different dynamics and different patterns and problems in all sorts of different relationships between all sorts of people that look different. And there were some of the at least attempts that people had constructed in that book that were like, oh, this is interesting. Like, so here's this model that you're operating out of in Georgia, which is, you know, somebody that you find out who vandalized your car, and this person lives in the neighborhood and their family lives in the neighborhood. And you're like, well, restorative justice, repair it, fix the car. Otherwise, like, we and your family are all going to give you crap, or like you get paychecks, you're going to get a second job, like pay this stuff off. And that's like monetary. But like a restorative justice model is, okay, this person killed someone in your family. Restorative justice, maybe that person, I mean, assuming that they'll do this sort of thing, like feels bad about it, and they're like, you know what, I'm going to replace the labor they were supplying to your family, and I'm going to like do work around your house, or I'm going to, yeah. I mean, I could see something cathartic also about, and just like, at least it's not everybody having to walk through this process of like, okay, go to the meeting, okay, self-denounce, you know, did you read this chapter of the Paul Kivel book? Okay, let's talk about it. But like, I can see both sides. And I personally think that although it takes a lot more work, the idea of whatever community means, the idea of trying to sustain relationships that have a degree of cohesion, or a degree of at least like respectable interaction, and where there's the assumption that if someone screws up, they're going to try to make amends or be asked to make amends, doesn't seem that bad to me. It's when there's the institutions that are going to force someone to do labor for the sake of the institutions and call it justice for the victim's family. That's problematic, you know?
Yeah. I hear what you're saying, and I just, like, today my temperament is not there.
That's fair.
Maybe yesterday it was, maybe tomorrow will be again. I'm not really sure. The issue for me is more about the person who feels wronged getting some kind of wholeness back through whatever mechanism they find is the most appropriate.
Yeah, I see that.
I don't know. I don't know how I would want something like that done for me. I guess it depends on how badly wronged I would feel.
So I've had you on for an hour and 25 minutes, and since you said the word issue, what's up for issue number 77 of AJOTA? I know it's a long ways off, but do you have any teasers for the folks in the potential reading audience?
The only thing that I can say is that I will be reviewing several books. Eriko Malatesta, here, the volume one of the promised multi-volume set from AK Press. Malatesta was one of my favorite anarchists historically. I'm also probably going to do a quick and dirty review of a book that came out in 1998 called Key Concepts in Postcolonial Studies. Basically, a short encyclopedia, interesting topics, and what I'm going to do is look at the way that they were described in 1998 and take a look at how they're described in 2015.
So how the terms are being used within academia, you mean?
Yeah, like how, or not even academia, but in the activist world. So how things started to come different, and the way that post-colonial or decolonizing discourse has been filtered through Marxism and filtered through anarchism. And there'll be plenty of periodical reviews as well, at least three or four. We don't have a central essay at the moment, but I'm always working on one about the role of history in anarchist practice, the importance of what I think is the importance of history, and studying it, and not as a way to relive it or refight the fights of forebears, but to generate some kind of lessons for the future, present future.
And are you, is there general solicitation for articles and reviews from the public? Like, can people just send in the work that they have?
Sure. We don't guarantee anything when folks send us stuff unsolicited, but we do accept people's writings. We will happily look at things, and if they seem like they fit into the general trajectory of our project, we will work with the authors and try to help them make their writing better.
And if they're going to contact you or look at, if people want to check out articles or reviews from past issues, how can they find that out and how can they contact you?
Well, the website is anarchymag.org, and you can link to contact, or you can just write editor@anarchymag.org, and all your questions will be answered. I hope. That's my email, editor@anarchymag.org. You can also write me at lawrence@anarchymag.org.
And if folks were to, if they sadly do not live in an area where one of the newsstands or bookstores carry it, where can folks find copies of Anarchy Magazine?
Well, you can ask for it to be carried at your local municipal library. We are connected to several subscription services, institutional subscription services. So you can request it through your local library. You can request it through your local university library. You can subscribe to it yourself. You can ask to distribute it. You can ask your local info shop to carry it, your local independent bookstore to carry it. And we are open to any and all of those inquiries. Happy to make some kind of connection with people who are interested in the magazine.
And copies can also be gotten from LBC's website?
Yes, Little Black Cart distributes it. Our primary internet distribution, Little Black Cart.
Is CAL publication still a thing?
Yeah, we publish pamphlets.
Okay. Yeah, I remembered there was the Cal Press Review and Anarchy, and I guess Modern Slavery is a product, like, under that umbrella, too. And I know that, like, Anarchy
yeah.
After Leftism and, like, a few other things have been published through Cal.
So Modern Slavery, so Jason's project is still CAL Press. Ours is still CAL Press. They have different P.O. boxes, and we do different projects. It's the same umbrella outfit, but we don't collaborate explicitly. We're sister publications. Our snail mail address is Post Office Box 3448. That's in Berkeley, California, and the zip is 94703.
We've been speaking with Lawrence Jirach. Lawrence is, again, the author of many articles on many topics and is currently a co-editor of AJODA, or Anarchy Journal of Desire Armed. Thanks a lot for taking the time.
All right, thanks a lot.
Yeah, take care. You're listening to WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, North Carolina. This is The Final Straw, a weekly anarchist radio show airing on Sundays between 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I'm Bursa Goodness.
And I'm William Goodenough.
The show can also be heard on KXCF in Marshall, California, KWTF in Bodega Bay, California, KOWA LP in Olympia, Washington, and WCRS in Columbus, Ohio. The show will later be archived at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. You can email us at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net with anything you want. And you can send us snail mail at The Final Straw, care of Asheville FM, 864 Haywood Road, Asheville, North Carolina, 28806. This show is brought to you by Firestorm Books and Coffee, located at 610 Haywood Road. Firestorm Books and Coffee is a worker-owned cooperative in Asheville specializing in offbeat, underground, and independent literature. Firestorm's full catalog of books and zines can be found online at firestorm.coop.